biopsy operation was unnecessary and unfortunate, but irrelevant. I explained, apologized, and defended myself in a series of letters, which the hospital management rewrote in the third person and sent off to the father with the chief executive's signature. The father was not satisfied and demanded a complaints meeting, which duly took place some months later. A smartly dressed middle-aged woman from the Complaints and Improvements Department, who I had never met before and who obviously knew nothing about the details of the case, chaired the meeting. The dead man's elderly parents sat opposite me, glaring with hatred and anger, convinced my incompetence had killed their son. I spoke to the parents, unnerved and frightened by their anger, and became quite upset. I tried to apologize, but also to explain forcefully why the operation, although a mistake, had nothing to do with their son's death. I had never had to attend such a meeting before, and I don't doubt that I made a mess of it. The complaints and improvements manager interrupted me and told me I should listen to what the patient's father had to say. I therefore had to sit for what felt like a very long time, while the bereaved man poured out his grief and anger. I was told afterwards by another manager present at the meeting that the lady from Complaints and Improvements was silently weeping as the old man described his suffering, for which I was held to be uniquely responsible. I learned later that the day of the meeting was the second anniversary of his son's death, and he had been to visit his grave at the local cemetery that morning. The Complaints and Improvements manager eventually dismissed me, and I left the room feeling very shaken. I thought that would be the end of the matter, but a few weeks later, the chief executive of the hospital trust rang me on my mobile entirely out of the blue just a few days before Christmas. He was a new appointment, recently parachuted in by the Department of Health because of the Trust's parlous financial situation. His predecessor had been suddenly and ignominiously dismissed. I had met this new chief executive briefly when he started. As with all NHS chief executives in my experience, I have now got through 8, they do the rounds of the hospital departments when they are appointed, and then one never sees them again. Unless one is in trouble, that is. This is called management, I believe. "I'm giving you advanced warning of a meeting you are to have with me in the new year," he announced. "But what's it about?" I asked, immediately anxious. "That will have to wait until the meeting." "For Christ's sake, why are you ringing me up now, then?" "To give you advanced warning." I felt frightened and confused, and could only assume this was the desired effect of the phone call. "What am I supposed to make of that? Advanced warning about what? I've just about had enough of working here," I said pathetically. "I feel like resigning." "Oh, we can't have that," he replied. "Well, tell me what the problem is then," I cried. "It's about a recent complaints meeting, but it will have to wait until the meeting." He refused to tell me any more, and the conversation ended. "Happy Christmas," I said to my mobile phone. The meeting was scheduled for early January, and I spent much of Christmas brooding over it. I may appear to others to be brave and outspoken, but I have a deep fear of authority, even of NHS managers, despite the fact that I have no respect for them. I suppose this fear was ingrained in me by an expensive English private education 50 years ago, as was a simultaneous disdain for mere managers. I was filled with ignominious dread at the thought of being summoned to meet the chief executive. In the event, a few days before I was to meet him, I suffered a hemorrhage into my left eye and had to undergo emergency surgery for a retinal detachment. Perhaps because of my impaired eyesight, I then fell down the stairs at home a few weeks later and broke my leg. Once I had recovered from that, I then suffered a retinal tear a lesser problem than a detachment in my right eye, which required further treatment. By the time that I was back at work, it seemed that the chief executive had forgotten about me, as had I our conversation on the telephone. I made one of my regular trips to Ukraine, and shortly afterwards I was sitting in my office, catching up on the paperwork that had accumulated while I had been away. "You're in trouble again," Gale shouted through the doorway between our offices. "The chief executive's secretary telephoned. You've been summoned to a meeting with the chief executive and the director of surgery tomorrow at 8.' On this occasion, I knew well enough what the meeting was going to be about. 2 days earlier, after running up the stairs to the second floor on my way to the morning meeting, I was taken aback to find that the doors to the female neurosurgical ward had an enormous 3-foot by 4-foot poster stuck to them. On it there was a huge no-entry sign in ominous red and black, with the grim instructions beneath: "Do not enter unless your visit is essential. Some patients on this ward have an infectious illness." I turned away in disgust and went into the X-ray viewing room for the morning meeting. The juniors were discussing the poster. Apparently there had been an outbreak of norovirus on the ward, an unpleasant but usually harmless virus that used to be called winter flu. My colleague, Francis, marched into the room, waving the poster in his hand, which he had clearly pulled off the ward doors. "How fucking ridiculous can you get?" he shouted. "Some moron from management has stuck this up on the door to the women's ward. Are we supposed to stop going to see our patients?" "You're a naughty boy," I said. "You'll be in trouble with the management for removing it." After the meeting, I went down to my office and sent an email to the hospital's director of infection control, complaining about the poster. No doubt I was now blamed for its removal. At 8 o'clock next morning, feeling apprehensive and defensive, I made my way along endless corridors to the labyrinth of managerial offices in the heart of the hospital. I passed the doors for the manager and deputy manager for corporate strategy, the interim manager for corporate development, the director of governance, the directors for business planning, for clinical risk, and for many other departments with names I cannot remember, almost certainly all created as a result of expensive reports by management consultants. The Department for Complaints and Improvements, I noted, had been renamed yet again and was now the Department for Complaints and Compliments. The chief executive's office was a suite of rooms, with a secretary in the outer room and a large room beyond with a desk at one end and a table with chairs around it at the other, just like the offices, I thought a little sourly, of all the ex-communist apparatchiki and professors I have dealt with in the former Soviet Union. The chief executive, however, was not going to use the bullying and bluster of some of his post-Soviet counterparts, and instead welcomed me enthusiastically and offered me coffee. On the other hand, some of the nicer post-Soviet professors would welcome me in the morning with vodka. We were joined shortly afterwards by the director of surgery, who said little throughout the meeting, his expression one of irritation and exasperation with me and of deference to the chief executive. After the usual niceties, the question of the infection control poster came up. "Just for once," I said, "I followed the proper channels. I sent an email to the director of infection control." "It caused great offence. You compared the hospital to a concentration camp." "Well, I wasn't the one who copied it to everybody in the trust," I retorted. "Did I say that you did?" the chief executive replied in a stern and headmasterly tone. "I regret saying concentration camp," I said with some embarrassment. "It was silly and a bit over the top. I should have said prison." "But didn't you remove the poster?" asked the chief executive. No, I didn't, I said. He looked surprised, and the room was quiet for a while. I had no intention of sneaking on my colleague. And there was a problem with the complaints meeting last year. Yes,